title of this lecture is Youth Culture Comes to Church, A Different Gospel. This is Tape 5, Side B. Again, a few thoughts for us to begin, just to give you a little something to chew on as we start looking at this particular topic. C.S. Lewis, in his fascinating book, one of his best books, though I've been questioned for my thought about that, The Abolition of Man, which is a book about primarily about education for character. Here's what he says. And all the time, we continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. We make men without chest and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the gelding be fruitful. Don Myers, in his book, All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes, says, entertainment reaches out to us where we are, puts on a show, and then leaves us essentially unchanged, if a bit poor in time and money. It does not, and usually does not claim to, offer us any new perspective on our lives or on other matters in creation. And then from T.S. Eliot, this poem. It's just a bit of his poem. The church disowned, the tower overthrown, the bells upturned, what have we to do? But stand with empty hands and palms upturned in an age that advances progressively backwards. And then from Screwtape in C.S. Lewis's book, Screwtape Letters. All is summed up in the prayer which a young female girl has said to have uttered recently. Oh, God, make me a normal 20th century girl. Thanks to our labors, this will increasingly mean... This is Screwtape, the tempter devil. I'm sorry I didn't define that. Thanks to our labors as tempters, this will increasingly mean, make me a minx, a moron, and a parasite. And then finally, Rodney Clapp in his book, Families at the Crossroads. The Christian home is a mission base. When we refuse to shop for churches after one church has bored or inconvenienced us. This tendency betrays the blatant consumerization of our faith. When a family struggles to stay with the church through bad times, it demonstrates another way of life than that so relentlessly promoted by the economic exchange model. I was 12 when I first visited the ocean. We went to visit family in Galveston, Texas. We arrived just in time for a brief swim in the Gulf before the sun went down. I remember my shock of the first time of tasting the salt water in my mouth. I remember my mother's warning me that the ocean had these strong undercurrents, and much to my disappointment, she stood with a watchful eye, ensuring that I would not venture out more than knee-deep. I promised myself that if I ever got back to the beach without her, things would be different. When I got to high school, my brave pastor took 4 carloads of us, our total youth group and then some, to camp on the beach for a weekend. Even commando mosquitoes, clingy sand, and 100-degree-plus Texas weather could not spoil this trip for us. The first morning at the beach, we let the adults set up a place we could call home base, and we threw ourselves at the waves with a passion. For hours, we played tackle the kid with the ball, king of the raft, and body surfing. Finally, our stomach screamed loudly enough to send us out of the water in search of food. As we walked to the shore, our group was nowhere to be found. We saw no home base, no familiar cars, no slightly overweight sunburned pastor in sunglasses and hush puppies. It didn't take long for us to realize that while we were concentrating on having a good time, the current had carried us hundreds of yards down the coast without our even knowing it. And because we were being carried along by the current, we didn't notice its strength. In much the same way, teenagers in our churches are being carried along by the strong currents of a culture, but they can't feel it. Unless our youth programs work intentionally to resist these currents, our efforts at discipling youth may, in fact, simply entrench them more deeply in the very values that are in the strongest opposition to the Christian gospel. In this chapter, I want to identify 3 dominant currents of our culture. which are more than simply neutral cultural backdrops or landscape against which children in our time grow up. These are currents that can, in fact, push our young people away from maturity in general and from Christian maturity in particular. The first one of those currents is individualism. Recently, I was at a restaurant that's frequented by students from a local high school known for encouraging nonconformity. As the students walked in, it didn't take me long to recognize that every student was from the same school. How could I tell? Every one of the nonconformists were dressed exactly alike. Particularly striking were the three senior boys with carbon copy haircuts. They sat at their table with identical postures, manners, and vocabulary. These students, who prided themselves on their individualism, did not have the power to resist the conformity that individualism always demands. Individualists may live with the delusion of fierce independence. He or she is the most likely candidate for codependence, or what Scott Peck calls a passive-dependent personality disorder. Why? Individualists, by definition, have freed themselves from loyalties that might in some way tie them down. But liberation from all loyalties beyond self cuts a person off from roots that bring the stability and identity necessary to stand against the currents of our culture. The idea that deep within each one of us there is a genuine self, completely separate from our roles and relationships, is nonsense. If you take away my roles as husband and father and Christian and pastor and friend, there isn't any private self there to discover. As Robert Bellay explains, myself is composed of my relationships and commitments, my roles, if you will. That doesn't mean I lack autonomy. Indeed, only because of my relationships and commitments can I be autonomous at all. If I were isolated, I would be helpless. Some rejoice over the return to traditional family values in our culture. Realistically, this trend must be understood as one more phase in the evolving conformity of individualism. After all, family values are in these days. We'd be unwise to get our hopes up. This too shall pass. The persistent current of individualism has radically changed the character of the American family. Carl Schneider in the Michigan Law Review has observed that family members today tend to view themselves as, quote, a collection of individuals united temporarily for their mutual convenience and armed with rights against each other. Individualistic Christians, carried along by the culture more than by the gospel, have come to define all their commitments in terms of self-realization. Marriage is seen as personal development, work as personal advancement, and church as personal fulfillment. When asked why they attend church, the individualist response is always, because I get something out of it. Christian individualists learn to approach God as a doting old grandfather, a mush God, perhaps a cross between Big Bird and Mr. Rogers, the kind of friend who would never say no. It's this sort of understanding of God that led a college girl to argue vehemently, my Jesus wouldn't think it was wrong for me to sleep with my boyfriend. And it's that kind of understanding of God that leads musicians who use blatantly immoral lyrics to thank God when they receive their Grammy Awards. Christians carried along by the current of individualism cannot help but create a God in their own image. Several years ago, Vanderbilt beat the University of Tennessee in a barn-burning buzzer-beater basketball game. One of our students from Vanderbilt made sure he called his father, a UT graduate, to gloat over the game. The father's only comeback was, you have to admit that UT did have the strongest single player on the court. The son quickly responded, yeah, Dad, but that player maybe needs to take up tennis. Basketball's a team sport. Christian discipleship is a team sport as well. It always happens in the context of Christian community. Even if we're talking about Thomas Merton or the Desert Fathers, those were people still deeply rooted in Christian community, even in the midst of their solitude. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. One of the goals for our youth ministry is that our teenagers will grow to become independent in Christ, that they'll be able to stand alone when their faith calls them to do so. But there's a clear distinction between healthy independence and the unhealthy cultural current of individualism. The independent person has the power to say no because his or her identity is grounded in a heritage of secure relationships. The individualist can only do what he or she wants. Do you get that? The power to say no comes from our rootedness in relationships. When we are independent or we are individual, we are separated from those relationships, we really don't have the power to, we can only do what we want. The independent person is secure enough to serve or give without being consumed in the process. Individualists whose only identity is in themselves will become consumed in validating their identity and proving their worth through serving or achievements or relationships or activity. Todd is an independent college student who still calls his parents his heroes. He was deeply involved in our youth ministry before going off to college and developed strong connections with a number of Christian adults. During high school, he attended a boys' school in which his short hair, khakis, and button-down Oxford shirts were the accepted dress. But Todd chose to grow his hair long, quite a creative accomplishment in a school where hair must be off the ears and off the collar, and wear clothes quite different from those of his peers. And although he chose never to experiment with alcohol and drugs, many teenagers and their parents looked at him as an amoral druggie. His poetry only hints at the courage he developed on his journey toward independence. No one wants to hear my inner song. Smoke your dope, boy. Your hair is long. Breaking stereotypes would use your mind. Are you afraid of character you might find? When the majority sins, nobody cares. Just lynch the different, the one who dare. Ones who dare. For your bigotry, there is a season. Clean image complements your moral treason. With his feet firmly planted in his family and his extended family, Todd had the courage to stand against the crowd. Churches that are carried along by the current of individualism can inadvertently train teenagers that being a Christian is primarily a personal and individual affair. The unspoken message to teens involved in these churches is that their personal faith decisions are all that really matters. This belief is found most notably in the scores of young adults who argue, "I don't need to go to church to be a Christian." I've often wondered what would happen if football coaches approached their work like most youth ministers are expected to, or if most players approached their work like the teenager I just described. If they said, "I don't have to be with a group to play football." Well, I guess he's right. I guess you can throw the football in the air, but is that really football, to play it without a team? But I've wondered what would happen if coaches approached their work like youth ministers are expected to approach youth ministry. For example, I wonder what would happen if when a player was too busy to show up for practice, the understanding coach would say, "Oh, we'll miss you. I hope you'll be able to make it next week sometime." Imagine the players leaving practice and hearing the smiling coach say, "Hey, thanks for coming. Hope you'll come back tomorrow." If a football team operated like a typical youth ministry, we might expect concerned parents to call the coach saying, "Can you tell me what's been going on at practice? My son says it's boring and he doesn't want to come back anymore. I was wondering if you could make it a little more fun for them. And by the way, you might want to talk to that coach across town. He seems to have the right idea. Their kids seem to have a lot of fun and they're winning too." The coach might send out quarterly questionnaires about what the players would really like to change about the team. I can just imagine their answers. Shorter practices, more winning. A coach responding like a typical youth minister might first feel guilty that the practices were not meeting the boy's needs, or he tried to adjust his program to suit this boy and every other boy whose parent complained. Between trying to keep everybody happy and giving every student a good experience, the coach would squeeze in a little football practice. And what kind of season would the coach have? Well, it's a safe bet that that coach wouldn't be the only one who felt like a loser. But this is the very way that most churches expect to run their youth ministries. To expect that youth be committed to church at the same level of commitment that would be expected on an athletic team would draw the charge of legalism or insensitivity. Our culture has been so carried away by the current of religious individualism that the expectation of commitment to the church has become implausible to most Christian parents. Because the God of individualism pressures us to program to the lowest common denominator, we seldom raise the expectations high enough for teenagers to experience real community. Real community means real responsibility for each other. It means a commitment to be there for each other, even when the schedule is tight and when the motivation is low. But the typical Christian adult in the church knows little about this kind of commitment and community. In our city, there are 5 prominent evangelical churches. And like good individualists, many of their members move among those churches as easily as they change their clothes. When they feel they need a little more liturgy, they move to the charismatic Episcopal church. When they're looking for a little more freedom in worship, they try the fast and loose Pentecostal church. In the mood for more substantive teaching, the conservative Presbyterian church will do the trick. For these enthusiastic Christians, loyalty to a specific community, which can often be quite bothersome, is rejected in favor of finding a place that, quote, meets my needs. What would happen if marriages, and I'm thinking there's a pattern here, what would happen if people got married with the same level of commitment that they join a church? I'm going to stay with you till I don't feel like it anymore, until it doesn't meet my needs. True intimacy in relationships comes over the years, in what one playwright said, in what you've been through together. And in fact, what many do is as soon as they get close to a level of depth and intimacy in a community that often almost always means some chaos and confusion and some conflict, as soon as they get to that, they leave there supposing that God must be, because there's confusion, God must be calling them somewhere else rather than calling them to hang in there and work it through. Most youth ministers have their files jam-packed with lessons that promise to build young people's self-esteem. But positive self-esteem is gained by repeated interaction with others who've gone before, by affirmation and connection to a genuine community. If we hope to move our young people toward mature Christian adulthood, the discipline of community needs to be a central focus of our program. Our teens' spiritual maturity will be limited if our teaching and program center exclusively on personal, individual faith. If all they experience is this kind of teaching, chances are they'll simply grow fat without ever growing strong. The second cultural current that many of our churches seem to have absorbed is the cultural current of entertainment. One of the favorite images of the late 1980s was the couch potato, a person spending his or her life on the couch watching television, experiencing everything secondhand. Couch potatoes sit, wait, and react. When they get bored, they simply change the channel to something more exciting. Through consumer-oriented entertainment, our teenagers have been conditioned to seek pleasure or the avoidance of pain as the goal of life. From the kids who lick slimy secretions from toads to get high, to others who wear the party-till-you-puke philosophy plastered all over their lives, pleasure has become serious business. A group of teenagers was asked recently, what images come to your mind for the word party when you think about your peers? The response? Keg of beer, drugs, sex, loud music, getting destroyed, totaled, wasted. Excuse me. Hammered, annihilated, decimated. What caught my attention about this study was not the typical teenage responses, but the way the teenagers described their images of partying in passive terms. See, all of these descriptions indicate that teenagers perceive fun as something that happens to them. Next to sleeping, the teenagers that we work with will spend more time watching television than pursuing any other activity, if they're average. Is it any wonder that approximately 3/4 of teenagers surveyed in the Search Institute study indicate that they thought church was boring? And incidentally, I've seen recently that if we're shocked by the amount of television teenagers watch, the fact is that adults watch on an average more. I don't know of any youth ministry that can, week in and week out, compete with a $92 million movie. Compared to most other options young people have for entertainment, we don't have a chance. If we train our youth to expect entertainment from church, we can be assured that when things get a little slow, they'll be switching the channel to somebody else's show. The 1989 Gallup poll discovered that 95% of teenagers believe in at least one supernatural phenomenon. For example, angels, astrology, Bigfoot, ESP, witchcraft, ghosts, clairvoyance, or the Loch Ness Monster. And why not? These beliefs require no investment. They require no commitment. They can simply be held passively without any risk or involvement. Entertainment center programs provide an artificial intimacy, sort of like a crowd at a rock concert, without the joys or frustrations of real relationships. But when drawing teenagers through exciting programs becomes the goal of a youth ministry, we're in danger of teaching them that the Christian life will always be a party. Some Christian sociologists have called this generation of teenagers God's little brats. They're growing up with the expectation that they should never be bored, never be uncomfortable, never have to do without. I've discovered an interesting phenomenon. Often the most spiritually responsible adults have come from miserable youth programs, where there was no youth pastor to blame for the problems of the group. These young people and their parents had to take responsibility for their youth ministries. They've had to struggle with the failed attempts to get programs off the ground. And these young adults are often the best prepared to live the Christian life that doesn't get neatly fixed in 30-minute blocks. Youth ministries that are carried along by a current of entertainment will create their youth as consumers. And their leadership will do everything it can to, quote, keep the customer happy. This fact may explain why the majority of church teenagers do not know why we celebrate Easter. Cannot even name the four Gospels. Learning the basics of the Christian life takes work and it takes discipline, the very demands that just might keep youth away. Most church teenagers have just enough knowledge of the Gospel to inoculate them against ever being transformed by it. They know bits and pieces of the biblical story, but they know the Disney myths much better. Every one of them could tell you what happened after the handsome prince kissed Sleeping Beauty, but few know what Abraham, Isaac, and a knife were doing on a mountain together. Young people who develop a low tolerance for boredom will be unable to practice the disciplines necessary to grow in the Christian life. Prayer and Bible study, fellowship, witnessing, fasting, solitude, they're all disciplines that have at their very heart facing our own sense of boredom and restlessness. Okay, the third current of the culture, what I call looking good, or the cultural demand for success. A 1991 report described the results of a cross-cultural study designed to determine the prime causes for misbehavior in adolescence. Researchers identified two universal factors associated with misconduct. Not surprisingly, the first was the level of parental monitoring. That is, limited parental participation was a likely indicator of adolescent misconduct. The second factor was more surprising. The study showed that the more a teenager valued outward success, the more likely it would be for that teenager to misbehave. Youth in each of these three countries, the USA, Australia, and Hong Kong, all reported the same trend. Values like wealth, power, and a comfortable life, and social recognition were strong predictors of misconduct. In this culture where human value is often reduced to how much one produces, teenagers are often seduced into bowing down before the false god of success. But as the research indicates, teaching our young people to place a high value on success does not always have positive consequences. James Dobson, in his classic book, Preparing for Adolescence, describes how teenagers are often victims of a cultural system that tells them if they're valuable, they're valuable if they're physically attractive, if they're intelligent, and if they have money. As long as young people depend on these visible signs of success for their self-esteem, they remain dependent and immature. Henry Nouwen was a highly respected professor at an Ivy League university. Having written a number of best-selling books on Christian theology, he was a sought-after lecturer, a man of no small stature in his field. His convictions about the nature of the Christian faith, though, led him to leave his prestigious position and join the staff of an institution that cared for adults with mental disabilities. In his new position, no one recognized him as anyone special, except in that he was a part of the community. Nouwen's move represented his refusal to allow his identity before God to be tied up in his ability to perform or to produce or to succeed. He explains, "It seems easier to be God than to love God. Easier to control people than to love people. The leader of the future will be the one who dares to claim his irrelevance in the contemporary world as a divine vocation that allows him or her to enter into deep solidarity with the anguish underlying all the glitter and success and bring the light of Jesus there." For Christians, measurable success can never be our primary goal. Judas was looking for visible signs of Jesus' success. The Pharisees demanded signs to prove that Jesus was speaking the truth. But according to the New Testament, Jesus never did anything to build a crowd. As a matter of fact, he often tried to do just the opposite. Visible signs of success were not high on his priority list. If we place success over faithfulness, we will inevitably choose image over substance, in danger of becoming ecclesiastical public relations directors rather than ministers of the gospel. One of the college students who works with our teenagers was asked by some parents, "What are you going to do when you graduate from Vanderbilt?" He explained that he was considering full-time ministry with teenagers. Later, I couldn't believe what I happened to overhear. One of the mothers in our church said, "How can he do that to his parents after all the money they put into his education?" Image over substance. Youth ministries teach young people that success is the real priority when they use only good-looking adults for youth leaders. We train them to seek success first when we consistently recognize those who visibly accomplish the most. We demonstrate how highly we value success when the youth minister cannot handle having a program that fails. Our young people may learn more about discipleship by watching their leaders struggle than by following the seemingly magical gurus who find success second nature. Young people do not need our help in learning how to handle success. They need training in living with failure. All the great success stories I know of have more failure in them than success. Abraham Lincoln, Louis Pasteur, Martin Luther are all known for their success but face failure over and over again. And I'm told that every great songwriter in Nashville has a much larger trash pile than a hit pile. When our youth ministries tacitly teach the doctrine of success first, we're in danger of raising a generation so afraid to fail that they are paralyzed to take the risks necessary to live the abundant Christian life. When the young people leave our meetings thinking, "Those guys are good. How do they do it? I could never do anything like that." We've taught them not to risk, because to do so could mean they wouldn't measure up. Youth who graduate from a success-centered youth program learn to treat God as the most efficient means to their success in life. They learn to pray because it works, or because it makes me feel better. These young people grow up to be adults who are surprised by struggles and wonder how a loving God could ever let them suffer or fail. A ministry that is leading teens to mature Christian adulthood will often find itself going against the stream of each of these three values. If you'll remember the picture that I described earlier, where you have the two walls with like a canal with water running through it. If on one end we have kids who are born, and the other end we have them at mature Christian adulthood, and the walls on either side are the family and the extended Christian family. What we'd have to say is that these values of our culture are outside of that stream, and they blow against faith maturity. Unfortunately, most youth programs take place outside of the stream of the family and the extended Christian family. And so they're much more susceptible to those values of the culture. Just like a child whose parents are not attentive is much more susceptible to internalizing the values they hear on television than is a child who has attentive, involved parents who are giving an alternative set of values. That diagram is most easily understood as a canal through which the child's faith flows toward maturity. The thesis, you remember, of family-based youth ministry is that the family and the extended family of the church are these structures, these walls, that most naturally move a person to faith maturity. And as a teenager moves to adulthood, the extended family of the church will begin to have the most formative influence on that young person's faith. The primary task of family-based youth ministry is to pass the baton of faith formation from the nuclear family, or from the youth ministry, to the extended family of the church. Because traditional youth ministry takes place outside these structures, young people in those ministries are more susceptible to the juvenilizing forces of the youth culture. Now the implications for ministry. Number one, the only way to combat the encumbering influences of modern youth culture is to connect teenagers to adults who are moving against the culture. These relationships can give young people courage as they go against the flow. Again, what I hope you're hearing is a very simple message that clearly documents the setting and the culture in which we have to do this and the unique challenges. But the message is very simple. The message is we've got to find ways to connect our kids to significant Christian adults if we hope them to grow and to be mature adults themselves. Number two. It is very appropriate for leaders to ask the young people in their group to be committed to the community of faith as they are to an athletic team. For example, showing up for practice even when they don't feel like it. And number three, churches can invite interested teenagers to participate in community spiritual disciplines that allow them to face their boredom and not run away from it. For example, fasting, or concerts of prayer, or days of silence. And here's the wild hair. Have an annual boredom fest. A night when everyone is together with nothing planned, no games to do, no materials, no pool tables or ping pong tables. Or take a year to enjoy as a youth group another church's Sunday night programs rather than taking time to plan something new each week. That ends our fifth tape. Our last tape, we're going to do some theological reflection. And then just do a collection of ideas, ways that we can put into practice the things that we've heard. Just a smorgasbord of implementation ideas. So at this point, if you'll fast forward this tape to the end and cue it up for your next listening, that would be great.